Today, I'm going to be reading the story of the Pilgrims and the First Thanksgiving, written by Bella Coral. One August day, 400 years ago, in the harbor town of Southampton, England, two children, Giles and Constance Hopkins, were waiting with their parents below decks on the three-masted sailing ship called the Mayflower. With another ship, the Speedwell, it was being loaded with food and water and the many other things needed by families going to a new land across the ocean. For days, the Mayflower sailors had been carrying furniture, utensils, and tools into the hold of the ship. Giles and Constance laughed now as the men hoisted up squealing pigs and struggling goats. The squawking of chickens and barking of dogs added to the noise. On the passenger list were Brewsters, Winslows, Carvers, and Bradfords, names that were to become famous in America's history, and their children were called by names that seem strange to us today. Love and Wrestling Brewster, Remember Allerton, Resolve Dwight, and Humility Cooper. Most of them were pilgrims, people who traveled to distant countries seeking freedom to worship God in their own way. They were leaving England because their king was forcing everyone to go to the same church and pray to God exactly the way he ordered them to. If they refused, they were driven from their homes and sometimes thrown into prison. Their religion meant more than anything else in the world to the pilgrims. Some years before this, they had gone to Holland, a country where people could worship as they pleased. They had found peace and security there for a while, but as their children began to grow up, they seemed to be losing their English ways and customs. The pilgrims were disturbed by this. "We cannot let our children become strangers to us," they said. So they had returned from Holland to sail to America. The rattling of chains was heard as the anchor was heaved up, the Mayflower and the Speedwell put out to sea. Giles and Constance were on deck some hours later when they saw signal flags go up from the Speedwell. She had sprung a leak. Both ships sailed back to England. Some of the Speedwell's passengers remained behind, but others joined those on the Mayflower, which was now more crowded than ever. Besides a crew of 50, she carried 102 passengers. This time the Mayflower sailed from Plymouth Harbor. The small craft tossed in the rough waters of the Atlantic. The seasick passengers huddled in their narrow bunks. Many were also ill of scurvy because they had no fresh fruit or vegetables. Usually their meals consisted of hard biscuit and salted or dried meat, but sometimes they made a charcoal fire on sand placed in an iron box and cooked a nourishing porridge or stew. Many days passed. The crowded ship grew more uncomfortable. There was no place for the passengers to bathe or wash their clothes. Food rations had to be reduced. Then came a great storm. The ship rolled and pitched in the huge waves. Everything in the cabins was upset. Some of the smaller children had to be tied to their bunks. They were all afraid they might have to return to England, but at last, the sea became calm, and the pilgrims gave thanks to God. When they saw the sun again, Constance and Giles laughed with joy, and their happiness was all the greater when their baby brother was born aboard the Mayflower. What will you call him, mother? We'll call him Oceanus, for he was born on the ocean, she said. The Mayflower sailed on. More and more people became ill. Everyone was afraid the supplies would not hold out. We've been on this boat for 63 days now, said Constance one afternoon. She and Giles were leaning across the railing, watching the water. Suddenly, Giles cried, I see a dead tree branch out there. It means land, shouted the sailors. Never were more welcome words heard. Sick and weary men and women thronged the deck. Children clambered up the rigging. Their fathers and mothers talked of Virginia, the part of America where they were expecting to land. The climate would be mild, and other English settlers who had founded the Jamestown colony there would help them in the new land. As the Mayflower neared the shore, the passengers saw evergreens and pines growing down to the beaches. This was not the sunshine and flowers they expected in Virginia. Indeed, it was not Virginia. Atlantic storms had driven the Mayflower far off its course, and the land that lay before these pilgrims was Cape Cod. There would be no English friends here to welcome them, or houses to shelter them. Instead, there might only be Indians and wild beasts, and it was winter, bleak and cold. But the pilgrims were grateful that their long and dangerous voyage was over, and they knelt to thank God for their safe arrival in the new land. Before they anchored, the Pilgrim Fathers named John Carver as their governor, and they signed a document, later called the Mayflower Compact, one of the most important papers in American history. In it, they agreed to make just and equal laws for all in their colony. On November 11, 1620, the Mayflower anchored off what is now Provincetown Bay. High hopes filled the hearts of the pilgrims as before them stretched the shores of this new land. But first, a landing party of 16 men had to explore inland, to find a safe place to build homes. They had heard much about the danger of Indians, so they put off in their rowboats, wearing helmets and breastplates and carrying muskets. Their leader was a soldier, Captain Miles Standish. He had been training some of the men in the use of arms. Constance's and Giles's father was in the expedition. The children stood on the Mayflower's deck watching the rowboats take off. They watched anxiously as the men waded through the shallow, icy water and pulled the boat up on the beach. Throughout the long, cold day, they waited for their father and the others to return. It was almost dark when the men came back, cold, wet, and tired. They brought back juniper branches for firewood. As they dried their clothes about the fire, the men reported on their trip. They had seen no Indians at all, and the only animals they had met were some squirrels and a rabbit. The soil is too marshy and sandy for us to settle here, though. We could not grow enough food, said Mr. Hopkins. As soon as they could, some of the women and children went ashore and had a much-needed wash day. They scrubbed the clothes and water they got from a freshwater pond they found nearby. And what fun the children had racing on the beach after all those days on the ship! A few days later, Captain Standish led another party ashore. The pilgrims had heard about corn and wanted to trade with the Indians for it, for if the grain seeds they had brought from England would not grow here, they were afraid they would starve. This time the men stayed ashore for 3 days. At last they saw some stubbled fields that the Indians had planted. At first the men found no corn, but then they saw some strange sand mounds. They dug them up and found fine Indian baskets filled with yellow, red, and blue corn, baskets so heavy it took 2 men to lift them. Now they would have plenty of corn seed for the spring planting. Some day, they hoped, they would find the Indians who left the corn there so they could pay for it. Another larger expedition set out again, going farther inland. The men were camping for the night by an open fire when they were startled at dawn by a horrendous yell from the nearby woods. "Indians!" cried Captain Standish. "Arm yourselves!" A shower of arrows whizzed past them. The captain and another man sent blasts from their muskets towards the woods. Again, savage yells rose about them. As dawn grew brighter, the captain saw a strapping young brave leaning behind a tree, aiming an arrow at him. Whang! The arrow flew, but the captain ducked in time. He pointed his musket at the Indian. There was a fiery flash. The bullet splintered the bark of the tree. 3 times the captain fired, and each shot hit the tree. Bark and wood splinters fell all about. After this barrage, the Indians had enough, Mr. Hopkins told his family afterwards. They ran into the woods shrieking. We followed them, firing a few shots, so the Indians would see we weren't afraid of them. A few days later, the pilgrims sailed across the bay. Again, they sent out an expedition from the Mayflower to find a good harbor and a place to settle. 18 men, guided by Captain Standish, William Bradford, and John Carver, came to the shores of what we now call Plymouth in Massachusetts. They named it after the English town the Mayflower had sailed from. On a cold, sunny December day, they landed. Plymouth would be a good place to build homes, the pilgrims thought, for they found cornfields that the Indians had left long ago. There were lots of fish and many rivers and brooks to give them fresh water. The women and children lived on the Mayflower while the men cleared land for a settlement. A few days before Christmas, a new baby, Peregrine White, was born, the first English child born in New England. He was an ancestor of mine, by the way. On Christmas Day, the wilderness quiet was broken by the noise of swinging axes, crashing trees, and shouts of the Pilgrim Fathers. First, they put up a common house to serve as meeting place, church, and storehouse. Then they built 7 small homes, one for the Hopkins family. But during that hard winter, the pilgrims were cold and hungry most of the time. Their food stores grew smaller every day. Wintry storms howled about their flimsy houses, and many of the settlers became ill. By the time spring came, nearly half the people who had come over in the Mayflower had died. Then the sun began to shine. Trees burst into bud and songs of birds rang through the woods. Spring had come at last, and soon it would be seed planting time. Constance and Giles were happy to explore the beaches and the woods about the village and to bring home varieties of plants and flowers unknown in England. One day, while some of the pilgrim children were down at the beach gathering clams, Constance was startled to see an Indian walking towards the common house. Every settler well enough to stand on his feet came to see the visitor. He was tall and wore a leather girdle about his waist, and he carried a bow and two arrows. To the amazement of the pilgrim, Samoset, as the Indian called himself, spoke some English. He had learned it from fishermen who had come to the main coast where he lived. The pilgrims realized that it wouldn't do to let the Indians know how low their supplies were, so they gave Samoset a good meal of roast duck, cheese, and pudding, which he ate with relish. Samoset enjoyed himself so much, in fact, that he would not leave. Finally, it was decided that he spend the night at the Hopkinses, while the women folks slept at a neighbor's. So it was that Giles slept under the same roof with an Indian. Captain Miles Standish stood guard, not yet quite sure Samoset could be trusted. When he left next morning to return to his people, he carried with him a ring, a knife, and a bracelet that the pilgrims gave him as gifts. Later, he came back with another Indian named Squanto. Squanto and Samoset reported that the great Indian chief of the district, Massasoit, would visit the white men. Massasoit would visit the white men. Soon the chief, bringing 60 braves with him, was camping on a hillside. Now there were only 30 men left among the pilgrims. They were afraid of what might happen. Squanto brought a message from the chief. "Send a man to Massasoit to say you are friends," he told Governor Carver. Edward Winslow came forward. "I will go," he said. He walked toward the hill carrying biscuits, butter, knives, and a copper chain for the chief. While Winslow was held as a hostage to ensure the Indians' safety, Massasoit, with many of his braves, came down the hill. The Indians wore deerskin leggings, and their faces were brightly painted. Captain Standish and his men marched forward to meet them, firing their muskets in the air as a salute. Then they all marched to the meeting house, where rugs and cushions were spread on the ground for Massasoit to sit on. Governor Carver, wearing a red sash and a feather in his hat, welcomed them. A drummer beat a tattoo, and a trumpeter blared forth a few notes on a trumpet. The Indians were familiar with drums, but the trumpet astonished them. Massasoit tried blowing it, but couldn't make a sound. After this, the settlers offered the Indians food, and then Englishmen and Indians made a treaty, promising not to injure, but to help one another if trouble came. And they kept this treaty for 50 years. Squanto stayed on with the pilgrims and became one of the best friends they had. Indeed, they might not have survived at all if it had not been for him. Squanto spoke much better English than Samoset because he had been taken to Europe by an English captain and had lived in England for several years. He had lived in Plymouth before the pilgrims came there, and when he came back from England, he had found his tribe gone, wiped out by a plague. He had been too long with white men, however, to be happy with Samoset's people. "Squanto is your friend, and will stay with you," he told the settlers. One day in April, Squanto approached some men who were digging in the fields. "Time to plant corn. Oak tree leaves now big as squirrel's ear," he said. They would use the corn seed they had found in the Indian mounds on their first trip inland. Giles watched as Squanto showed them the Indian way of planting corn. First, he made little mounds of earth a foot apart. Then he dug a small hole in each mound and put into the soft earth three dead herrings and three corn kernels. He covered all this with earth again. The fish, which at this time of year filled the brooks around Plymouth, had started their run. They fertilized the soil and helped the corn grow well. It was back-breaking work to carry the baskets loaded with fish up the steep hills to the planting fields and then to plant the corn. And now there were only 20 men and 6 boys to do it, but they did it. Soon it was time for the Mayflower, which had been anchored in the bay all winter, to go back to England. Everyone knew hard times still lay ahead. It might be many months before another ship arrived. But when the captain asked, "Does anyone want to return with us to England?" not one of the pilgrims wanted to go back, though many of the men looked sad and stern, and the women had tears in their eyes. But no one could be unhappy for very long after the Mayflower left. There was too much to do. When autumn came, the pilgrims, with Squanto's help, had raised a good crop of corn, as well as wheat and barley. Now they could have plenty of food for the coming winter. After the harvest had been gathered, Governor Bradford called a meeting of the settlers. He had been chosen their leader after John Carver died of sunstroke while working in the fields. Bradford, a good and able man, was to guide the colony for 36 years. "We have much for which to give thanks," the governor said. "Our houses are snug and ready for winter. None shall go hungry or cold. We have made friends of our neighbors, the Indians. Let us set a special day to thank God for all he has given us." The day for the Thanksgiving feast was set. The pilgrims decided to invite Massasoit with some of his braves to share in their rejoicing. The chief sent 5 deer as his gift toward the feast. The pilgrim fathers went hunting and brought back wild ducks, geese, and turkeys. The women and girls cooked, baked, and roasted, while Giles and the other boys kept the fires going with logs from the forest. Tempting smells of stews and puddings, of roast venison and turkey, must have drifted over to the Indians' camp, for Massasoit came with 90 men. Dressed in deerskin leggings and shirts, they had feathers in their hair and painted stripes on their faces. Massasoit wore the copper chain the pilgrims had given him on his first visit. Tables were set up outdoors, and the governor and Massasoit sat together. Elder Brewster, the minister, said a prayer, giving thanks to God for their shelter, food, and safety in the new world. Giles noticed how seriously the Indians listened, though they could not understand the words. Their people, too, had Thanksgiving prayers of their own. Heaping platters of venison, turkey, fish, and geese were set on the tables. The Indians all ate as if they were hollow to the knees. Giles chuckled when he saw a brave pick up a whole turkey and gnaw away at it till it was nothing but bones. The pilgrims ate heartily too. After all had eaten till they could eat no more, there were games of quoits. The boys ran races, and the men held wrestling matches. The boys ran races, and the men held wrestling matches. Captain Standish paraded and drilled his soldiers to the beat of drums as the Indians watched. The Indians showed their skill at shooting with bows and arrows. Bonfires were lighted as evening came, and Massasoit's men gathered in a circle and sang, danced, and whooped around them. At the end of the dance, they tossed handfuls of corn on the hot stones near the fire. The kernels leaped in the air, popping open like white snowflakes. Constance picked up a piece and put it in her mouth. It was her first taste of popcorn. The Indians must have enjoyed the Thanksgiving feast, for they stayed for 3 days. The pilgrims did not forget the sad times they had been through, and they knew there would be more hard times to come. But they had much to be thankful for, and they were free in this new land. They were free to work and to worship God in any way they chose. Because they were brave and held fast to what they believed was right, the pilgrims will be remembered as long as our nation stands. Now I thought I would read the Mayflower Compact. In the name of God, amen. We whose names are underwritten, the loyal subjects of our dread sovereign Lord King James, by the grace of God, of Great Britain, France, and Ireland, King, Defender of the Faith, etc., having undertaken for the glory of God and advancement of the Christian faith, in honor of our King and country, a voyage to plant the first colony in the northern parts of Virginia, do by these presents, solemnly and mutually in the presence of God and of one another, covenant and combine ourselves together into a civil body politic for our better ordering and preservation and furtherance of the ends aforesaid, and by virtue hereof to enact, constitute, and frame such just and equal laws, ordinances, acts, constitutions, and offices from time to time as shall be thought most meet and convenient for the general good of the colony, unto which we promise all due submission and obedience, in witness whereof we have hereunder subscribed our names at Cape Cod, the 11th of November, in the year of the reign of our sovereign Lord King James of England, France, and Ireland, the 18th, and of Scotland, the 54th, Anno Domini, 1620. And now to finish a poem, The Landing of the Pilgrim Fathers by Felicia Dorothea Hemans. The breaking waves dashed high on a stern and rock-bound coast, and the woods against the stormy sky their giant branches tossed. And the heavy night hung dark the hills and waters o'er, when a band of exiles moored their bark on the wild New England shore. Not as the conqueror comes, they the true-hearted came, not with the roll of stirring drums and the trumpet that sings of fame, not as the flying come in silence and in fear. They shook the depths of the desert's gloom with their hymns of lofty cheer. Amidst the storm they sang, and the stars heard, and the sea, and the sounding aisles of the dim wood rang to the anthems of the free. The ocean eagle soared from his nest by the wild waves' foam, and the rocking pines of the forest roared. This was their welcome home. There were men with hoary hair amidst that pilgrim band. Why had they come to wither there, away from their childhood's land? There was woman's fearless eye, lit by her deep love's truth. There was manhood's brow serenely high, and the fiery heart of youth. What sought they thus afar? Bright jewels of the mine, the wealth of seas, the spoils of war? They sought a faith's pure shrine. I call it holy ground, the soil where first they trod. They have left unstained what there they found, freedom to worship God. Have a happy Thanksgiving. Bye.